Going to open the meeting. The House Committee on Agriculture, Natural Resources, and Rural Communities will please come to order. Today we have invited testimony on, it's really more than two topics, but it'll be from kind of two panels and then an opportunity for public comment. The reason in the first case that we're talking about transfer of development rights, because some would also consider that something within the land use jurisdiction, is our House Interim Committee developed a TDR bill that we'll be seeing shortly, and I didn't want that to be the first time you ever heard the term or the concept or what is involved. A lot of work was put in, so I don't believe it will be a controversial bill, but just in case, you will have at least an education on not necessarily the bill particularly, but the whole concept and what it entails. So when we hear that bill in a couple weeks, we'll be able to be more informed as a starting point. Then we're also going to hear an update that the interim committee heard, but we have obviously some change from the interim committee till now, and that's on the subcommittee of this committee that was formed and for one day and held a field hearing in Prineville on the sort of issue of destination resorts, and particularly as it affected the farmers out there. We had about 150 or so, I think, probably folks, or maybe it was 100 to 150 show up, many of them growers. This committee, obviously not everybody was here for that presentation. It wasn't a huge one. I just commented on it briefly in the interim, so we're going to get a little more formal thought. It was a joint committee between our subcommittee of House Ag and the LCDC met. So the commission met, and we held our hearing simultaneously or concurrently. And then I forget what the other topic you guys are covering is in this part, but TDRs, destination resorts. Oh, and then some conversation about the EFU. All right, okay. So with that, let's get started unless people have initial questions. Obviously, later in the meeting, we're going to talk about ethanol with Brent from the Department of Ag.
Where is he?
What's the first question? I should be able to pick that. What city is that? That's Prineville?
Yeah.
I wish it was. I think it is. Golf course right by town? Yeah, it's got to be. Yeah, there's nods in the back. And the only actually compensated Measure 37 claim in Oregon, I think, was right in Prineville, wasn't it? Up on the Rim Rock? Yeah. You can almost see it. All right. Thank you. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Clem and members of the committee. I'm Bob Rindy. I'm Senior Policy Analyst and Legislative Coordinator for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And with me today is Michael Morrissey, who's also a Policy Analyst and will be doing legislative coordination for the agency, and Catherine Daniels, who's our new Farm Forest Specialist. Many of you remember Ron Eber, and Kathy's filling in that role now. What we wanted to do today is, very briefly, I was going to give you, first of all, talk about this report you were just commenting on, and what we generally do in these presentations is try and give committees an understanding of the statewide land use program and our department, and I'm going to not do that today. Instead, I've brought a couple of pieces of paper to help you through that, and if you do want me to meet individually with some of you to talk about the background of land use planning, to get you up to speed on some of this stuff, I would be happy to do that. But what I did want to talk about was especially that for farm and forest land throughout Oregon, as many of you know, the statewide land use laws are largely a regulatory program, and land use the program works by LCDC established some broad goals on planning and zoning for farm and forest land. All 36 counties implemented those with farm and forest zoning. Catherine's going to talk a little bit about how that's going, but about 1995, we started doing this project where we began looking at other states and the land use planning that has been done in other states. And one of the things that stands out in my mind was that we discovered that many other states have some or one or another of components of Oregon's land use program, but something most of those states have that we don't have is a program to transfer development rights as a market-based, voluntary way for development rights on farm or forest land or other resource land to be purchased, possibly banked, and then transferred to another location as a means of preserving farm or forest land without a regulatory process. So we are now working on trying to establish that kind of a program in Oregon, and we have our agency has a bill on that, and as Representative Clem mentioned, the interim committee worked on one as well. Our bill is a pilot project because we want to try out some different scenarios, but there's also a broader authority that may come from the interim committee's bill. So I asked Catherine to come here today to talk about that, especially because she has worked in other states and established transfer development programs in those states. And so we're very fortunate as an agency to have her come on now, right when we're trying to do this, and be able to take advantage of some of her expertise. She's also recently done our Farm Forest Report, which we do every 2 years, to take a look at what's been going on with farm and forest around the state, and she can give you some brief summary of that. And then when she's done, we would segue then to Michael to tell you about destination resorts and some other legislation that our agency is floating on that topic. So unless you have some questions with that, Catherine will give you your
question.
Are we leaving? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we leaving the transfer of development rights now?
Actually, we're about to start on
that. Oh, forgive me.
All right, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The heart of Oregon's land use planning program, this is Catherine Daniels, Department of Land Conservation and Development, Farm and Forest Land Specialist. This is my first time up here. The heart of Oregon's land use planning program is really farm and forest land protection. I may be biased, but the counties have zoned about 16 million acres of land across the state for exclusive farm use and almost 12 million acres of land for forest and mixed farm and forest uses. The Oregon program is widely regarded across the country as the most successful farm and forest land protection program that there is. I think that's a well-deserved reputation. Each biennium for 25 years, our agency has been required to report to the legislature the type and level of land use activity that's been occurring in the counties across the state, and we provide to you at that time a farm and forest report. This report is based on information that the counties provide to us on the number of land use approvals, including new dwellings, other land uses, and land divisions within their boundaries. LCDC just approved the most recent two-year report for 2006 and 2007 last week, and we will be providing that to you next week. Over the years, these reports have been really useful, both to the legislature and to LCDC, in terms of spotting trends in land use activity across the state, and it's been the basis for the legislature to do some fine-tuning of the statutes over the years, and also for LCDC to do some fine-tuning as well through our rulemaking process. You have a summary sheet before you of the results of the last two-year report, and without going into all the numbers, just in general, the trends have been very consistent with past years in terms of the level of activity and the type of activity. In the two-year period, there's been about 2,500 new dwellings approved in both EFU and forest zones across the state, about 800 new parcels created. An interesting fact is that a full 90% of the new dwellings and land use divisions that have taken place have been in eastern and southern Oregon, and that is because we have more flexible standards in those parts of the state. One concern we do have and we want to look at in the future is the cumulative impact of 3 decades' worth of non-farm dwellings that we haven't really analyzed to date, but that we want to start looking at in the future. We do also have some concerns with the siting of some of these non-farm parcels in that they are sometimes interfering with the conduct of farm activity on adjacent parcels. We want to look into that. A concern on forest land is one that Department of Forestry Director Brown alluded to the other day, and that is the breakup of some of these very large commercial timber holdings into large tract residential properties now that we are not confident are being continued to be managed for forest uses. We share Director Brown's desire to look to be creative in finding ways to add value to this property for landowners to help to keep these lands in forest use. Another important measure of the success of the program is not just the activity that's occurring within EFU and forest zones, but also the level of rezoning out of those zones to other urban and rural uses. And there's 2 ways to do that in Oregon. Lands are rezoned to urban uses when they're included within urban growth boundaries as part of planned development. They're also rezoned into rural development uses. And here the trends have really shot up. There's been about a doubling of land that's been rezoned to rural residential use from EFU and forest zones over the last 2 years. So that is a trend that has increased. But that shows you as well that there is some flexibility in the program and an ability to move land from one zone to another development zone. And in addition, several counties have over the years identified about 86,000 acres as non-resource lands. Okay, those are lands that have never been identified as farm or forest lands because they don't meet the definition of farm and forest lands. That remains an option for counties to use for lands that they feel do not meet the definition of farm and forest lands. Though Oregon has undisputably the most successful farm and forest land protection program in the country, we recognize that it leans very heavily on a regulatory approach and on zoning as a single tool, and that a toolbox with a variety of approaches would provide greater long-term assurance of the program's success and more choices for landowners. And along those lines, a particular tool that we do support and embrace and that we hope the committee will be enthusiastic about and we want to follow up on, as Bob mentioned, is transfer of development rights. This is a tool that's been growing in popularity across the country. I have provided a handout to you that was put together by the American Farmland Trust. It includes a number of counties and states across the nation that have been using TDR. And, in fact, the list is somewhat dated. There are a number of additional communities that are using it as well. New Jersey, the state of New Jersey, just launched last year a statewide transfer development rights program. But this is, as Bob said, a voluntary market-based approach in which development is redirected from areas that communities identify as places that they want to preserve and protect, typically farmland, forest land, could be wildlife habitat land, this sort of thing. Direct this development into places that the same community feels are more appropriate for growth and development. Typically, these are areas with existing infrastructure or planned infrastructure within urban growth boundaries adjacent to them, perhaps unincorporated communities and even other places. In this kind of scenario, a willing landowner may be willing to sever the development rights that they have on their property and sell them to a developer who then is able to use those development rights in an area that has been designated as appropriate for development. And that developer will then be able to gain a greater density of development or other development benefits that he otherwise would not be able to have without those development rights. So it's really a win-win kind of situation. Oregon is really ideally set up for a program like this because we've done all the hard work already of identifying what would be the sending areas that could be protected, the farm and forest areas, and the receiving areas that would be largely the urban areas that would receive the development. It's an extremely low-cost program. Once it's set up, it operates basically through the market, It has a minimal governmental component to it. In exchange for the landowner receiving compensation from the developer for the development rights that have been transferred, the landowner agrees to record a permanent conservation easement on their property, and then that property is preserved forever. So what you have is compensation that comes to the landowner, and you have the permanent preservation of land, which are two advantages that we don't now have in our current program.
You okay taking questions as we go?
Absolutely.
We've got a couple already. Mm-hmm. Representative Schaffler, then Krieger.
Yeah, I just need to get this definition of sending and receiving in my head here of the right. First of all, I don't know what the right means, but let's say if you're a sending property, you already enjoy the rights to develop. Is that correct? And I need to follow up on that. So you already are zoned residential, commercial, industrial from the sending property. Is that correct?
Sending property would be normally a farm or forest zone.
So I need to, this, may I follow up?
Absolutely.
So it's already exclusive farm or forest use right now?
Right now.
So then if... So you're going to send rights you don't even technically have then to... I'm trying to get a hold of this.
Right, yes, Representative Schaffler. Yes, there are minimal rights right now for as far as development goes in farm and forest zones, but what many programs do is actually assign a greater level of transferable development rights than exist on the land under current zoning. For example, if you've got an 80-acre minimum lot size for a property, let's say in the Willamette Valley, you might actually assign development rights at one dwelling unit per 20 acres. And that would be the incentive then for the landowner to transfer the development rights. So there need
if
to be...
If I may, please.
Yes, please.
And you're going to have to get a flow chart for me. The receiving property... Okay, that is, does that property have to be adjacent or contiguous to an existing urban growth boundary, or can it be anywhere? And can it be on exclusive farm and forest use? Can receiving property be, does it have to be contiguous, adjacent to existing urban growth boundary and all the things that go with that? Or can it be out in the middle of nowhere where it's already zoned exclusive farm and forest use?
Okay, Chair Clement, Representative Schaffler, yes. Actually, it's typically, the receiving area is typically within or adjacent to an urban area. However, there could be several different potential types of receiving areas depending on the desires of the community and the goals of the program. It could be within an unincorporated community. It could actually be within a natural resource zone, under certain circumstances.
And then one more, and I'll shut up and move on. And then what development, the definition of development, does that mean construction? Does that mean residential, industrial, commercial buildings? Does that mean a gravel mine? What does development mean?
Chair Clem, Representative Schaffler, development can mean different things. In many programs, it means just residential development, but it can also mean commercial or industrial development. Typically, one development right translates to one extra dwelling that a developer is allowed to put in, but it can also translate to increased square footage or increased impervious coverage in the case of commercial or industrial uses, or waiver of certain development requirements for the developer.
Okay, indulge me with one more, yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schaffler.
Okay, I grew up in the Midwest, and populations, believe it or not, ebb and flow there. You may have a house, let's say out in Eastern Oregon, you have a house already, and it's been there for 100 years, but you don't use that house anymore. You're going to plow it up. Do you enjoy a right there? Can you take that and transfer that? If it's a house no one's going to live in anymore, is that an existing development right? Transfer.
Interesting.
Chair Clem, Representative Schaffler, I haven't heard of that approach, but basically these programs can be designed in any way that communities want them to be.
Well,
so okay. That's good.
Glad to hear that.
And the bill that we have coming from the interim is like that. It's for local governments or state agencies to set up, and they may define parameters where they really only want to send it into urban growth boundaries. We also had conversations about a city may say, well, what about right outside the urban growth boundary? There's some great farmland. We know at the next expansion it's going to be consumed naturally. That's the way the UGB growth works. What if we did want to preserve it? Could you talk to those growers and voluntarily get them to sign conservation easements by financing it with development rights that somebody else you know, so they give up their development rights, but then you have to figure out who's going to pay them for it. And so we talked about, could you get density bonuses in the city? Maybe a developer wanted to go 14 floors in a condo, and the city council, because of the neighbor, said, well, we only want 7. Well, maybe you get to go up to 10, but that extra 3 you paid, and then that goes out to buy the conservation rights. Another scenario is, let's say you've got Measure 49 rights now, so you got a couple approvals. Let's say you really don't want to build them, but you had the approvals. Somebody might buy those, so you don't end up building them, and then that goes into a bank and gets used somewhere else. But again, it's all voluntary on both sides, so the communities have to make it work for both the seller and the developer who wants to use them.
Mr. Chair, could I just for a second remind Mr. Representative Schaffler, the report that Catherine just summarized, all farm and forest land throughout the state, we still have a lot of development going on because there are rights for land divisions and dwellings throughout farm and forest areas. And so there's actually, and I can't remember the numbers she just quoted, but you heard them, they're quite high. I mean, there's a lot of development rights on farm and forest land. So what we're talking about is transferring those development rights. So, but the land would stay in farm or forest use and probably be more likely to be used for farm and forest use because you wouldn't have those intermittent non-farm dwellings if we can send those rights to other areas. And the bill that the agency has, you could send those to any other county or another city. It doesn't have to be adjacent at all. And we have our bill set up as a pilot because we want to actually experiment on the other question you asked about some different scenarios. We want to try a pilot where we transfer them to an urban growth boundary. We want to try have another pilot where we try transferring them to an area adjacent, perhaps a pilot where we transfer them to some other rural lands. And so we want to actually try out several different methods and see what happens over a period of 2 to 4 years and then come back to the legislature with the results of that in order to improve the program.
Representative Krieger, did you...
Chair. A lot of farmers, forest landowners, clear back in the original 37, made decisions not to take advantage of it because they valued what they had as a forest. Now, in my own case, I had 60 ocean view lots of the Rogue River Reef. The family sat down and said, no, we're not going to do that. Under 49, most of that would be gone. So how do I have, it isn't necessarily a compensation, but it would seem there's going to be a real inequity if you don't recognize what someone could have done under 37 compared to 49. Those lots were probably worth $500,000 apiece because of where they were located. There's a road to it. There's power to it. There's water. So, but we made a choice that we wanted that forest land to remain in the family as forest land. And you give up a whole lot that ends up being a societal environmental value. Is that going to be recognized in any way?
Well, Chair Clem, Representative Krieger, I would say that a TDR program would accomplish exactly what you say. It would provide value to landowners who do not want to develop their properties but would like to see some value for their land. That's the great advantage of TDR. You could actually have Measure 3749 properties participate in a TDR program so that the approvals that they're receiving now could be transferred by them off-site to other more appropriate locations.
Just one little follow-up. There's a lot of difference between under 37 and 49, what I can do on 310 acres. And so do we know yet how that would be viewed? How much is it just what would be allowed under 49, or do you lose everything that you had under 37 when we bought the property in 72? So we could have had total rights.
We have Mr. Morrissey who works in that area.
Chair Clem and Representative Krieger, and in my previous incarnation, I managed the Measure 37 and 49 programs, and I don't do that anymore, but I still have some sense of an answer to your question. I think the starting point is your development rights under current law, which might include some Measure 49 development rights. I don't really see a way to connect the dots, frankly, back to a Measure 37 right. Having said that, though, then it's a somewhat open question as from that starting point how this program works. So, for example, Catherine mentioned you might have one dwelling right on 80 acres, but this program may allow, for the sake of this transfer, two or three, or an assumption of two or three dwelling rights that would then transfer into a bank and eventually. But I don't really see a way to get back to Measure 37
Michael,
rights.
Since this is your first time talking, could you state your name? And
I'm Michael Morrissey, and I'm a policy analyst for the Department of Land Conservation and Development.
So, and I think, did you say how many acres?
310.
And it's 80-acre minimums to do a dwelling in a forest zone on the South Coast? So you would probably have three. I mean, you could split it up into 380s, and people could build houses now.
You only allowed a total of three, and I got
no,
two.
I'm just talking existing law. Forget 37 and 49. You could just split off and do three 80-acre parcels and sell them currently without 37 or 49. And this program would say, if you're willing to sign a conservation easement and not do that, we'll finance purchasing, you know, making it worth your while to not do that. And because you didn't file either 37 or 49, which was our case too, we could have and didn't. We're totally out of luck because we made a choice not to file.
That's right.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess mine would be a clarification and a question. First, the value that you set for your particular land, Representative Krieger or Representative Clem, could be whatever you say you want it to be. So it could be the same value you would have had for the five lots in a 37. You could just say, for my three lots, I want X number of dollars. So value-wise, it's what you choose to sell it for. So you can get the same value out of it. It just depends if the other people in the TDR are willing to pay that price. So that's where the market is going to decide those kinds of things. And I guess the other part from my perspective is I would hope as the agency moves forward, if this bill were to pass, I would like to see that where we're taking, where we're buying these rights has a different value. And I think Representative Schaffler talked about it. You could do it anywhere, and that's true. But from my perspective, I would hope we would be looking at migration patterns of elk and deer so that we buy these big swaths where there won't be houses in the way of the elk and deer going back and forth in those places, and so that we identify a place based on other criteria that seem to have significant value for all of Oregon. Or for that whole community, depending on if it's a smaller group doing it, so that now we have this unique place that has values that extend more than just the land, and we're going to set this other section over here that might be more appropriate because the water's more available, there's sewer, other kinds of available infrastructure, roads that are already there. So now we keep roads and stuff out of this other area. So and I guess that's kind of what I see this doing. Would that be a fair statement?
Yes.
Okay.
You can employ strategic objectives to your TDR purchasing to try and achieve other outcomes.
Right.
Representative Van Orme.
Well, I have the luxury of being a city commissioner in Oregon City when we had a health hazard annexation of septic failure right next to the city. We took in Park Place, a very expensive proposition for all of us. I also have the advantage of having a health hazard annexation not into a sewer system in Hood River County. So I'm very, very interested in where infrastructure, and it appears to be sewer, because most areas seem to have water systems. But the sewer systems are definitely, that need is definitely unmet. So one of the questions I have, does infrastructure ever come into these discussions, especially the sewer infrastructure, into these discussions of land development?
Mr. Chair, Representative Van Orme, again, I think that there's many challenges to establishing this program, which is why in our particular bill we are looking at a multi-year rollout of this, because there's lots of good questions. And I think one of the big challenges is finding the right receiving areas. No doubt there are many, many thousands of acres where we will probably find willing landowners to sell their rural development rights, just as we just heard. But finding the appropriate place to transfer those rights is going to be hard. In part, some of those you mentioned, there's lots of areas where it's really not a good place to transfer development rights, and we want the program to work to select the best places to transfer these.
And the theory behind the House bill is because we can't know all this in advance, let's set up a process, and then county commissions, city councils, maybe working with nonprofits that are already kind of in this business, they would come up with some systems and experiment in the laboratory of our communities on, you know, what might work for them.
Briefly, Mr. Chair. You know, Bob, you're going to have to come around and talk to me about this. I need help. But the way I'm seeing it now, maybe I'm wrong, we're establishing a saleable right that doesn't exist and underneath our land use laws may never exist unless it's contiguous to the urban growth boundary. And then we're selling it to somewhere that, and all where the way the conversation's going is, would be an appropriate place, which would be contiguous to a urban growth boundary, rather than out in an inappropriate place. So now we're going to overlay, you know, say, well, this is appropriate and this isn't. Well, someone may own some private property in that overlay where it says it's appropriate for protection. They may not want you to do that. This is a can of worms, is what it is, and put more. I'm reluctant to, at first blush of hearing this, to add one more cog into this land use wheel of ours. So I just wanted to share my concern here. So thank you for indulging me.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schauffler, you've identified, as we have, that this is hard to do. And again, we want to allow, this is an authorization. So it's not a new regulation. It's, in that regard, it's not a new cog. It's actually a new opportunity for landowners on a voluntary basis. And if a landowner doesn't want their area to be a receiving area, they don't have to sign. They don't have to buy any rights, any additional rights. But we recognize that in or adjacent to urban growth boundaries may not provide enough opportunities for receiving areas, and indeed, we have to look very carefully at whether there's some other places where we might be able to identify receiving areas beyond those to help this work, and that's what we hope to do. I think we'll have an opportunity if this bill comes up to go into a lot more detail on this. We hadn't intended to do that today, but.
One other question.
Representative Gilling, then we'll come back and then we'll try and move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is new to me, and I wasn't in on the interim discussion, but I just want to quickly ask, clearly there's great potential here, but potential for good and evil. And I keep wondering if trial lawyers are behind the whole thing.
Oh,
but. But I noted in the fact sheet all the states that are here, and I just wondered if you could say a word about, in a second here, about what it means when program revoked. Does that indicate some serious failures or some other issues? And lastly, what's the theory behind, I guess, the permanence of a transaction like this? Because you are selling your rights, but there's still nothing on that land. So how is it that we hold that in perpetuity as non-developable, what's the word?
That's close.
Yeah, thanks. How do we hold that as land that can't be developed in the next generation and the next generation? What's the permanence that we can be guaranteed, so to speak?
Okay, well, first to the first question, Chair Clem, Representative Gillum. Programs are revoked typically when they're not working well, and there have been a lot of failed TDR programs that have not been carefully crafted, and they have failed because one or more critical element was not included within the program. They've been around for long enough now that it's pretty well known what is needed to make them succeed and what's required there. Farm and forest properties that are permanently preserved through a conservation easement simply have had the development rights severed from them and transferred elsewhere. So they just are not allowed to receive development after that point.
And it's recorded on the deed.
There we go. Recorded on the deed, right.
Mechanism. Representative Beyer?
Well, and this is probably something, not having been involved in the discussions
That's
before,
why we're
I'm
having
a little
this here.
Bit over my head. But say you're in a city that's looking at their urban growth boundary and determining whether or not that needs to be revised. Is there any way this plays into that, or advantages or disadvantages to a city, or is it just a totally separate issue?
It could be part of the expansion of an urban growth boundary, or it could be occur separate from it. It could be either one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, for example, the city, and this was hypothetical, but the city might, at least under the bill that the department has, as a pilot, say, indicate to us that you're working with the county, and part of your urban growth boundary expansion, in certain areas, you may allow a higher density. You might set a base density, but then as part of your plan, indicate a higher density is allowed in those areas, provided those landowners purchase development rights that are available from the surrounding county or could be from other areas. And in that manner, working with that other local government or the county, you've established an incentive for property owners to purchase rights because they would have a higher density than they might otherwise be allowed. So, again, voluntarily, a city could use the urban growth boundary process at their option to help this program work.
We have one more over here, and then Representative Krieger, Representative Roman, and back to...
I think under 49, I can't recall, there were no commercial or industrial development, so could one of these rights be transferred off of forest land for that type of a development? And if it's close to an urban growth boundary that sometimes has wastewater and water already being supplied outside into that area, you'd be dealing with maybe system development charges, the cost of the land originally, and then the transfer cost. I'm willing to bet you some of this property is going to be so expensive it can't be used for housing probably. So kind of a question statement there, I guess.
We're going to be trying to set this up so it's very flexible, and some of that flexibility is going to make some people nervous. That's why we want to try it out as pilots. But it's not inconceivable that you could set up a process whereby, or a pilot program, let's say, whereby some of these rights would transfer. Perhaps Springfield would zone areas for industrial and allow a higher industrial or commercial density, provided that landowner purchased residential development rights from surrounding farm and forest land. I'm just saying hypothetically. We want to leave that flexibility in this process. We want to set it up so that willing local governments or conservation groups and others have options such as that in order to try and breathe some life into the program and make it attractive to landowners.
Representative Roblin.
Yeah, just a quick couple statements. First, most of the elements of this exist already. Example, conservation easements have been around for a long time, and people could sell those, and they are in perpetuity forever. we're in that same. So we're basically using an instrument we've always had that can be put on a deed. And the other part is that really what we're trying to do is add some different players to who have the resources to make investments that they think are important for the community. And I guess my mental example has always been, I really love having the opportunity to go out to Savi Island if I'm in Portland and buy produce and stuff that's that close to an urban area. And the people in that area may say, that's a unique place that we would like to have for all of our kids to be able to go get pumpkins or whatever they want to do out there. They have an opportunity to fairly quickly get out of the city and into a real rural area. And we think that has a value. So we're going to say, in Portland, we're going to exempt some of our rules for developers so that those developers will pay into a fund to do more development in those areas, say it's the Pearl District or whatever, and we're going to give them a few more things that we wouldn't give unless they paid something. That now gives them a fund of which they can go out and offer these people out here on this island money to say, keep it this way forever. Please sign us over so we always have this place that'll be special for for parking. And I guess that to me, the only difference this is from what we currently do with conservation easements is it allows people, different groups, government group or whatever, to make some of those decisions as they go and makes a market, basically a market that they trade back and forth. Is that how I...
And the one addition I'd make is the folks on Soviet Island who maybe had 200 acres, they had plenty of gross income to make four or five lots.
Right.
They would say, no, I'll take the payment and sign away my four or five lot option under the sort of minimum income, minimum acreage rules that they met.
Right.
So it was zoned EFU, but they also had the option because of their income and minimum acreage to do four or five houses. And now they're saying, no, I'll do it. I want to do it. Much like Representative Krieger, we made a decision as a family. The question is, do you actually get something for it, which you didn't, or could you maybe get something for it, which in this system you would, based on making a values choice to retain a working landscape instead of residential development in that particular area? Yeah, maybe. If the bank is financed and it works. Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to understand how this benefits the development side. I mean, what my initial instinct on this is that if I'm the city and I have an urban growth expansion, I'm not really going to allow any extra development. What I'm going to do is lower the bar of what I was going to allow, and then say to the developers, you got to go out and buy development lines out there to get what we normally would have done under the old system. But basically, in other words, it's kind of an extortion, for lack of a better way of putting it, where you essentially force the developers to go out and buy development rights from others to do what probably was what you wanted to let them do. In other words, you were going to zone here, but you zone down here and say the only way you're going to get back up to here is if you go out and buy development rights. I guess I'm trying to get my mind around where the real bonus would be and for the developer and why this system wouldn't really just be used to kind of extort some more cost out of them and then, of course, making everything just more expensive.
Chair Clem, Representative Wingard, there are some programs that have done it that way. That is not what we would recommend. That there are programs that have actually down-zoned receiving areas and then essentially with the development rights that are transferred brought them back to where they were before. That, I think, is a dishonest approach, and we would be encouraging communities to provide real incentives for developers that are over and above their ability to develop as it exists right now. And often those are density incentives, but not necessarily. Sometimes they can just be waivers of certain requirements. There's often, if you sit down with the development community, and it differs from community to community, there are particular things that bother them or disturb them or that they're not able to accomplish within a given community under existing zoning that perhaps can be the basis for crafting, you know, a set of development incentives that would really motivate them to want to buy development rights from landowners. So we're looking for honest, you know, true incentives for both the developers and the landowners.
And Chair Clem, Representative Wingard, I must say that one of the things we will be looking at, but very carefully, and part of why we want to do this as a pilot, is whether there are state regulations that we might relax in certain circumstances in order to encourage this to occur. I know that's something that makes farm preservation groups nervous and us nervous, frankly, but I think there might be some options, and again, I don't think we have time today to go into those in detail, but I'd be happy to meet with you about them, where the state, not just a local government, might be willing to relax certain regulations in order to encourage these rights to be transferred.
So I think we will wrap up our introductory primer on TDR, but I knew we'd be talking about this later, so I wanted to at least get us thinking about it and hear a little bit from Michael on the Destination Resort concurrent hearing.
Thank you, Chair Clem, and committee. I can make this pretty brief. I was asked to summarize a meeting that the chair already introduced. This meeting was in Prineville on October 15th. It was very well attended, and I think as many of you may know, there's been a lot of concerns about various aspects of destination resorts, where they are and how they're growing, and that prompted this joint meeting. I've handed out some material that was presented at that meeting, which included a good staff report by Bob Rindy on kind of the history of how destination resorts got going in the first place, and included some of the concerns that have been raised and were the cause of the hearing. So that's in your packet. Also, the statute ORS 197-435 through 467, which involves the destination resort statutes and our own department, Goal 8. So in there you will see the siting standards that are needed, the size of the lots, for example, and other information on what's required to get a destination resort going. The destination resorts, as you may know, there were 60s and 70s pre-land use program destination resorts or resorts, such as Salishan and Black Butte and Sun River. But the time period that really kicked off this current version of destination resorts was in the 80s with a land use committee that had Governor Atiyah on it and others, and they recommended that destination resorts be essentially a rural tool that would attract overnight stays and would help the rural economy. At this point, some of the concerns that came up, there were about 40 people who testified. There were quite a few people in the audience, but there were about 40 different people testifying at this at the committee hearings in Prineville. There were local government representatives. There were representatives of current or planned destination resorts. There were definitely neighbors and landowners nearby. At this point in time, Central Oregon certainly has kind of a certain density and population of destination resorts, and so there were many people from that area who had firsthand knowledge and a sense of what was strengths and weaknesses of the destination resorts. Some of the things they mentioned were impact on habitat, impact on water, impact on transportation, the ability or not to actually develop destination resorts, and now with the current economy, we're hearing that some have either been planned or been started, and certain aspects of the resorts are, in fact, on hold. Excuse me. The aspect of affordable housing for people who work in resorts, and in fact that's also linked to impact on transportation, where people are living who have to drive in to work on the resort, and it has a certain impact on communities and roads. Concerns about fire management and the geographical destination resorts themselves. There's some evidence, and there was some testimony that perhaps, especially in Central Oregon, I'll just say informally, maybe they're bumping into each other, and there may be some fiscal impact they're having, not only on each other, but on the rural communities around them. At the back of the package that I gave you, there's a table that was part of the staff presentation. This is only partly complete. It says attachment G on it, but it gives you some examples of some of the resorts, the size they are, the amount of development that's been allowed, the amount of development that has actually taken place. This does not include, for example, two mapped and planned destination resorts in Jefferson County, which are the subject of some interest. Does not include also a recently approved resort in Klamath County, which is Crescent Creek, I believe, and that's 5,000 acres. So this is kind of a sample of the kinds of things we're talking about.
And for your benefit, because you're probably wondering again why we're hearing about destination resorts, it's not my thought that we'll be taking this issue up in this committee, except possibly a bill that there is in the current law a limit on where you can place a destination resort vis-a-vis high-value croplands. And so you can't do it within 3 miles of high-value croplands. In the first piece of testimony we heard from, if I think it was Jim Johnson, actually, the Department of Agriculture, was that the list of high-value crops is no longer particularly relevant. There are crops that are on the list that people aren't growing anymore, and there are crops that should be on the list that would meet the definition of high-value. So this committee likely will hear a bill on that particular topic, on if you're trying to protect a high-value farmland or cropland from a mixed use, like a giant destination resort with a lot of traffic, how do you keep that list current? And that'll probably be the limit to all we deal with it until you're voting on the floor on things coming out of land use or something, just so you don't have to get too upset and excited about the destination resort issue. Yeah. Representative Shoffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. And I have a question. I don't know where the transfer development rights bill will go. I'd imagine that may well go to the land use committee.
I think it'll come here. It was an interim ag bill.
That would be interesting. Okay. I look forward to that. You know, I just have one simple question. And, you know, you mentioned Black Butte, Salish, and Sun River, and then you have these places here. You know, my frustration with land use in the state is no secret to anyone. But in light of this economy, I wonder if there's an estimate of how much money and how many jobs and how much revenue this building spends that comes from these projects that we wouldn't have had they not developed. Oregon is a beautiful place. I was not born here. I moved here because it is a beautiful place, and it's worth protecting and defending. But on the other hand, I just think we're out of balance. And the more I hear is, let's get more and more and more out of balance. And I have to confess to you, that's what I feel here. So I'm struggling with all of this. I just wanted to share that with you.
Chair Clem, I should be terrified to answer a question where someone says, I just have one simple question. Because, you know, hard to answer. But I can give you one example because the department head, Richard Whitman, and I were out touring Central Oregon about almost 2 weeks ago about destination resorts. Deschutes County said that their income or their revenues from destination resorts to the county were $28 million a year. And I think part of the question that one might have is, well, who gets the benefits from these resorts? Counties? Cities? What happens when you cluster them all in one area of the state, but other areas of the state don't necessarily get the benefit? So to the extent that there may be bills, and I believe there are bills that will be in various committees, it may be an appropriate time in a way to at least try to answer those questions, while in fact many of the resorts have sent signals. It's slowing down for us. I think the pressure to actually build them now and develop them now is a little different than it was 2 to 5 years ago. For now.
Okay. I think this panel's done, and then we'll move on to another non-controversial topic. If Brent wants to come up and talk about ethanol. Again, I think we'll probably have bills. They'll probably end up here on this topic, so I wanted to have a briefing that we received again in the interim, but so many members are new to the committee from the interim that we're kind of repeating a lot of this stuff just to get everybody the same base of working information.
Thank you.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Brent Searle, Special Assistant to the Director of the Department of Agriculture. I'll be speaking to the handout you're getting, so I'll pause a moment until you all have that.
And I'll introduce myself. I'm Warren Henderson, the Assistant Director with the Department of Ag.
So I think what we'll try to do is kind of stay at the 30,000-foot level unless you want to dive closer into some of the questions here, and we can try to do that. I'm going to try to address those 14 questions there. I won't read through them because we'll hit each one of them as we go on. So beginning on page 2, then, the inside of the cover, just setting the context about why biofuels and where we've come from. Prior to 2007, for a several-year period, at least 3 or 4 years, the Oregon Department of Energy led an effort to develop the Renewable Energy Action Plan. Several agencies, a lot of private interest stakeholders, a lot of hearings, a lot of work groups led to the development of that plan, and there were various legislative recommendations that surfaced through that and formed the basis of that plan. That served then as the framework for much of H.R. 2210, which was passed by the legislature 2 years ago. And some of the underlying policy or principles, objectives there are these main four items here. I won't go through these in detail. In fact, I'm going to move pretty quickly through a lot of this, so stop me if you have questions. But one of the premises is we would like, as a nation, as a state, to get away from importing so much of our reliance on foreign oil. So that's one of the premises there. You can see some numbers about projections on oil demand in the future. The drag that importing oil has on our economy was a huge issue that led up to some of the recessionary pressures. And finally, just to note there, 90% of the fuel we get in Oregon gasoline comes down from the Puget Sound. It's refined in Washington. And most of that is from Alaska. So we don't have a huge vulnerability to foreign sources here, but there is some vulnerability if those refineries or that pipeline have some problems, and we've seen that happen a few times, and you get price spikes because of availability. So having some additional biorefineries in this region, which add fuel to the market, can help stabilize those things. We'd like to retain more expenditures of Oregon's energy dollars in the state. Again, we don't have refineries or production here for oil, so adding biorefineries helps keep and add jobs and economic development. Again, goes to the third bullet. And finally, there's environmental and air quality issues. A lot happening at the national level, also driving the whole ethanol issue here. There was a phase out of MTBE, which was used in gasoline to oxygenate or add octane to the fuel and help with air quality issues. There were some problems discovered with that. EPA required the phase out of that use, and ethanol is the product of choice to replace that in the marketplace. And as I'll note later, fully 70% of the gasoline in the United States now has a 10% ethanol or higher blend in it. So it's almost pervasive in our marketplace now nationwide. The Energy Independence Act of 2007 set some volumetric goals of biofuels in the marketplace. Pretty aggressive goals, 14 years away, 36 billion gallons. That's about a quarter of our fuel supply. I think folks are backing off a little bit on that now. I think thinking that maybe have been a little too aggressive, but that's what they're shooting for. Congress recognized in creating this bill we can't run our transportation system on corn. There was a lot of, I think, maybe overexcitement initially about ethanol. I don't think anybody was saying we can grow enough corn to power our entire country, but that was kind of the feeling out there. And then the pendulum kind of swung the other way, and ethanol got blamed for everything. And I think it's coming back toward the middle a little bit, and I'll give you some numbers here. But the renewable fuel standard at the national level is 15 billion gallons cap corn ethanol, and that's as high as it can go. So it'll be with us for a long time into the future, but as far as the feedstock going into that, that is the cap. The rest of that has to come from advanced biofuels. Much of that is still in the works, other types of feedstocks. And stepping stone in that direction, one of the ethanol plants in Oregon received a fairly substantial Department of Energy grant for cellulosic conversion, Pacific Ethanol, $24 million, which will be matched by the company. So implementation-wise, 2210, in terms of building the industry here, has three basic components in there. One is incentives for farmers, landowners, and others to produce feedstocks. And so there's a wide range of incentives in there, and it's not just for ethanol. There's all kinds of renewable energy targeted and feedstocks, but that's one of the goals. Secondly is to build the processing infrastructure in the state, and that's basically continuation expansion of the business energy tax credit. Was enlarged from 35% to 50% of the eligible construction costs of facilities. And finally, the market access for biofuels to get into the marketplace more here in Oregon, and that is what we call the renewable fuel standard. In Oregon, that's a 10% ethanol blend in all gasoline sold in the state.
when the trigger of 40 million gallons in-state production capacity is reached. Our agency was tasked with monitoring that and notifying all of the respective interested parties of when that trigger had been met, and that was in late 2007. We held subsequent hearings and work groups and so forth dealing with what infrastructure was still remaining to be needed to phase that in, and determined that we would do it in three steps. So you can see those there, which counties were involved, and by mid-September of 08, the entire state now has 10% blend in the ethanol. So again, noting 70% nationwide here in Oregon, virtually all the gasoline is 10% blend ethanol. Working through this, anytime you go to something of this change in our transportation fuel structure, there are some bumps, and the 2000 legislature dealt with a couple of those in terms of exemptions.
2008,
yeah. Thank you. You can see those listed there, aircraft, watercraft, so forth. There are about 80 locations now where you interested parties can get clean fuel that's unblended. It's a little spotty on eastern side of the state still. I think that will increase as demand grows or that is identified. And what I've done on the next couple of pages for you, unfortunately you don't get a color version of this nice map, but there are a lot of activities at state levels across the country with biofuels, as well as the federal level. So these are the states that have an ethanol blend requirement. Many states also have biodiesel. Some of these listed here have biodiesel as well. But I've just listed the ethanol components. You can see the blend requirements, the exemptions vary a little bit, and yep. So the data there is on comparison to other states. Some are more expansive than Oregon. Some are a little less aggressive. I think we're kind of in the middle. We've tried to look at what other states did that were ahead of us and make those modifications, and we're all learning as we kind of go through this. Point seven, what do we produce in Oregon? There are three facilities now up and functioning. Pacific Ethanol in Boardman, 40 million gallons a year capacity. They came online, as noted, in late 2007. Cascade Grain in Clatskanie, 110 million plus gallons a year. They are currently down, dealing with some technical issues, expected to be up again functioning soon. But they came online a month or two ago. And then Summit Foods in Cornelius is a food processor, a blueberry processor that has diluted sugar-containing wastewater, and determined that they could use that to make something a little more valuable than wastewater. And so they're converting that to ethanol now, and so that's the small end of things, but 1 to 2 million gallons. I think we'll see more of that kind of thing as we progress into the future.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, yes, Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. Yeah. That right there, the corn, I grew up in Iowa and I have good friends that still live there. And when we were discussing this in 2007, they shared their concerns about it, the price of cattle feed, the price of tortillas in Mexico. It's been had an unintended negative impact on corn and its value and what we do with it. But right there, what you just talked about, the blueberry byproduct, that's the kind of thing I want to see come out of this. And my question to you is, we have a lot of cellulose in this state, in the forest, and we got a lot of stuff we burn off the fields out here that could go into that. Where are we at on that kind of research and development of technology where that could go into this rather than corn or whatever we're using now?
One grant you mentioned earlier was that type of research, too, wasn't it? For
yes.
I may have been out of the room. Forgive me, Mr. Chair.
No worries.
Chair Clem, Representative Shoffler. There's effort nationwide to go to what's called second stage or the next level of biofuels and getting more to biomass feedstocks. and away from what we might term food and animal feedstocks. I'll give you a little bit of data in a bit here. I think that was a little bit overplayed in the media and such, but we do have a fair amount of biomass here in the state. On the grass straw issue, Lane County is heading up a project. We're working with them. The grass seed growers are working with them. It's a collaborative effort, and they're looking at various ways to use that grass straw, either through digesters and producing methane gas to produce energy, or into bioethanol or other products. They're looking at other technologies as well. The Pacific Ethanol Plant is working on cellulosic ethanol at their corn facility. Now, one thing to keep in mind is this is a little bit like the progression of computers. I mean, you build one generation on the next generation, you learn from what you did. So there are over 150 corn ethanol plants around the country now, biorefineries. And biomass, once you got it broken down, is no different. It's sugar, basically. I mean, that's what you're trying to get to ferment and make ethanol. So those facilities will probably be many of them the same ones that produce the cellulosic ethanol. They're kind of building the foundation. We're still working on the front end issue, and when you talk about biomass, it's big, it's heavy, you can't move it very far. So these may be more regionally based facilities. A lot of our forestry biomass is in federal forest lands. There's still some entanglement about how do you get a long-term supply agreement with the federal Forest Service.
Wow, no kidding.
To do, you know, sustainable thinning and so forth. So that's an issue that's still being wrangled with.
So, thank you.
You're welcome.
Representative Van Orman, do you
have? Yes, Representative. Thank you, Chair. One of the questions that piques my interest based on Summit Foods was, I'm from Hood River County, and I was trying to think of what we have, and I know we have a juice plant that has a disposable after effect of creating the juice, and I was thinking, you know, there's a possibility there. But other than that, I couldn't think of any other way that we mash up the fruit or create a byproduct of the fruit.
The prices of pears keep going down. I've got a lot of them for you.
Okay. I guess that answers my question.
Again, I think we'll see more of those opportunities in the future as technology gets better to address those kinds of things. Another issue that's been tracked has been the question about economic benefits and jobs, both due to, I think, the incentives in House Bill 2210 and existing incentives, as well as the growing demand in the Northwest region, again replacing MTBE with ethanol and other things, led plants to site here. And so in 2007 and 8, between these facilities, you can see the numbers there, significant investments, lots of construction jobs. That should say about 90 full-time jobs. You can see the breakdown for Pacific and Cascade Grain. I will make a note. On these two facilities, they are somewhat of a different model than the Midwest, where you have the grain close to the facility, you convert it, you feed the livestock close by, and you ship the ethanol, and that goes in tankers or trucks. And the models in these two facilities were to ship the grain rather than the ethanol. And we move a lot of grain through the Columbia River and the Northwest Corridor, so this is kind of tapping into what was already going out. And grain is a lot easier to move than a flammable liquid in tanker cars and so forth. So that was their model. I think it remains to be seen whether that was a wise decision. I mean, the whole industry is having some challenges right now, but their model differed in the sense of moving the grain closer to where the ethanol was to be produced and distributed rather than trying to get the ethanol out of the Midwest. Our department, this is number 9 on the top of page 6, is involved with ensuring motor fuel quality and quantity. We inspect the distributor pumps and respond to any kind of complaints. We've had a few in this transition as we've gone through. Some of those were related to prepping of the tanks by the gas stations. They need to do that to make sure there's no water in them, that they've been cleaned up properly, and so forth.
Representative Roblin?
Yes.
It also came to me that they also are required to have another agency that now overlooks them because there's alcohol in the gasoline, and new equipment to monitor that. Is that true? You know, the local stations?
Chair Clem, Representative Roblin, I believe they have to denature the alcohol so it can't be consumed. and so there is another step in there. I don't know, Lauren, do you know anymore about that?
For the record, we might
Lauren Henderson, Assistant Director with the Department, Chair Clem and Representative Roblin. It is what Brent said, is denatured. I don't think there's another step beyond what we're already doing with the quality issues that I know of. They're already dealing with those agencies, DEQ certainly on the storage and those kinds of things. I don't think there was another regulatory scheme brought into that other than the denatured part of that process.
Thanks.
Okay, please continue.
Thank you. Item 10 here, the question often gets asked, do we have enough ethanol supply in the Northwest to meet the market? And just to put this in the context, BP ARCO for years has had ethanol in their gasoline, if you've ever bought it there. So they've been sourcing out of the Midwest for a long time. And most of the majors, the branded gasoline, still is sourcing out of the Midwest. A lot of the production that's happening in-state here is going to smaller independents, non-branded stations, also being shipped to California and up into Seattle. So, you know, fuel's moving all over the place. And in fact, one of these plants is shut down right now. A couple, again, of these smaller stations did have a short term where they didn't have contracts with other suppliers and had to scramble a bit. The point here is there's no shortage of ethanol in the United States. Getting it from one point to another can be a problem at times, but I think what we produce here in the Northwest allows, again, us to keep more of the processing dollars in the state. It allows us to we're a feed deficit state. It allows us to get corn and corn byproducts here for cattle, livestock feed, those other kinds of benefits. Briefly, on the food and feed questions, there was a lot of attention to this. Just know that 80% of the retail cost of food comes after it leaves the farm. On average, with grains, it's about 95%. So you get into the things with labor, transportation, processing, all those costs are added after the farm. So even with the price of corn doubling, the amount of corn in a box of cornflakes went from like 3 cents to 6 cents. It's very minuscule on those kinds of products. We'll talk about animals feed in a bit here. Several of the studies, and the majority of the studies out there, assign the contribution of ethanol or biofuels to the food price increase to be pretty negligible. And here are some of the other issues involved. During this time period, the price of oil, as you may recall, went up over $140 per barrel. The chart there you see was created in 2007. Didn't even have that level of oil prices on this kind of a chart. Compared to corn is the other line on there, which is still within the blip ranges that have been over the last 30 years. You had demand offshore, growing incomes during this period. They wanted more meat. They were importing a lot more corn. Talk about that more in a minute, but our corn exports were the highest in history in 2007 and 2008. The dollar decline had kind of a double whammy. Again, it pulled things out of the United States, created more competition, driving prices up. And we import a lot of our foodstuffs, particularly fruits and vegetables, 30%. Makes them more expensive, adds to the cost of the dollar. nothing to do with biofuels. We had drought and production issues worldwide, particularly wheat, some of the feed grains, again, leading to price impacts worldwide. And we've had record low wheat prices for a number of years, below the cost of production, and wheat production just has declined over the years and didn't keep up with demand. And then with the drought shortages on top of that, and I can go in more detail there if you like.
I have a question for you.
Yes.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. Yeah. And this, actually, there's a couple. This is a USDA report saying it has nothing to do with biofuels, price corn.
It assigned about a 4 or 5, less than 5% impact, yes.
And that's the USDA's findings?
Yes.
Okay. But in commodities, if I may.
Yes, please.
Commodities, and there was a drought in Australia that helped increase the price of wheat, if I'm not wrong. In any commodity, whether it be fuel or corn or gold, the demand has an impact on it, and the amount that's available has an impact on it. There's only so much corn in America, and we've created a new demand by saying we're going to put it into biofuels rather than feeding good Iowa corn-fed beef. And good Oregon corn-fed beef. Don't forget the Oregon cattlemen. It appears simple economics, and I'm a simple guy. They would tell me when there's greater demand for a commodity, that is going to drive up the cost. So to say, to come to a logical conclusion, I really have to question that. And there's this huge hue and cry, and you're giving me the information you've been handed, but there's this huge people out there screaming that it's having a direct impact, and they're all wrong. Is that correct?
Chair Clam, Representative Schaffler, you've got a good lead into the next page, and there's supply-demand production numbers there, so we'll get to them real quick here. You can see some of the other issues leading to food price increases. To get to the feed issue on a broader scale, again, yes, demand was up, again, worldwide. So you got demand up overseas, dollar cheap, creating demand. Those things led to price increases as well. As you note, corn makes up 40-60% of the cost production of many livestock products. It's been a big issue. One note to remember, ethanol doesn't evaporate corn from the market. About 25% of it by weight goes back into the feed market. So there's one factor to keep in mind. Secondly, production of corn in 2007, when all this attention started to be focused here, corn production in the United States was the highest in history. So supply went up to match demand. In fact, again, if you look at these numbers, corn production increased 2.2 billion pounds in 07. Corn used for ethanol went up 2.2 billion pounds. So the ethanol production and the corn production were essentially a wash. So if you took ethanol out and the demand that was created by that out of the picture, I would argue that your price relationships that happened otherwise would still have had happened, because you had export demand, a low dollar, that were pulling corn out of the country and creating a competition for that feed that wouldn't have been there otherwise. Again, in 2007 and 8, with the increase in ethanol that occurred in those years, we had the largest production in history, the largest exports in history, and the largest residual feed availability in history in the United States for cattle. But as you're right, the demand was pulling that up, but there were other things pulling on the corn price. One of these, I'll just jump back and touch on, was speculation in the stock markets. And this was significant. There were regulations lifted in the past several years on who could play in the commodity markets. Historically, it was only those that actually held title to the commodity, that you either produced it or used it in a product you bought and sold, and those are the only ones that could play in the commodities. Those regulations were lifted in the late 80s, early 90s, and gradually the investment, the index funds started to look at this. And if you look at item F on page 7, the commodity index funds, those pension index funds, other investments, went from $13 billion in 2003 to $260 billion in 2008, 20-fold increase in 2 years. So it's phenomenal. And what happened was this started to happen when the housing market started to go down and you saw commodity funds move out of housing and other funds and over into commodities, including oil. This is part of what ran up oil, part of what ran up all of the commodities, wheat included. And so that had an influence. So there were a lot of things pulling at the prices here. It wasn't just ethanol.
We have a question over here, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to acknowledge that the point you're making overall about how this bubble moved from real estate to commodities is correct. But again, to follow up on Representative Schaffler was saying, there's a reason why those investors were making a decision to move into commodities, and I think that had something to do with the regulatory and legal changes we were making to encourage the use of commodities for something other than, in this case, food production. And again, I want to be vocal about I don't think that these the facts that are given in here about how that affected world food prices being so low, I don't think that's correct. And I just want to be very clear that I think we have to take very seriously the idea of diverting food crops into fuel. And I think the hard part about having a discussion like that here is that we're having an effect on people very, very far away. And we are only part of the problem, if we are part of the problem, obviously, because other states and the Congress makes a decision as well. But I just have a sincere and deep problem with the idea, from a policy standpoint, of diverting food, which is, it is a world. I mean, whatever we produce here, it can travel anywhere, so it's all sort of fungible, if you will, or it can move worldwide. For us to divert food products to our cars, I think is a serious mistake.
Chair Clem, Representative Wingard, I think your point about policies having influence on this is certainly a valid point. Clearly, there was investment that followed the policy in that way, so that certainly had an impact. I would note, though, that when we're talking about the type of corn here, it's not food corn per se directly. People don't eat it. It's field corn. It's cattle feed. So, and the countries that we have historically exported to, we don't export field corn to Africa. Africans don't eat this kind of corn. The countries that are buying our field corn are China for animal feed, Europe for animal feed, and India for animal feed. Those are the big three. So when we talk about, food to our gas tanks, we're talking about livestock feed indirectly to go overseas. And again, the tortilla thing, that's a different kind of corn. That's white corn. That's Mexican. That's a whole other issue. I can go into detail on that if you like. But there were all kinds of issues that led to this situation. And again, record exports in 2007. We didn't short the world by putting corn into ethanol. We sent out more exports than we ever had before, including to Mexico. So that argument, to me, I'm not sure where we're shorting anyone in that dilemma if you look at the numbers.
I had one question. We're running out of time. But, I mean, this is the kind of exchange that I knew we'd have. We had a briefing like this. It changed a lot of my, at least, questions that I had about it, and I wanted to have everyone have the benefit of this because it's very interesting stuff. Didn't we write something specifically into our mandate about in-state production or where the source can come from to sort of protect against even raiding the Midwest entirely? Was it just that volume level, and once it reached the volume level, then it was triggered? But isn't there some other parameters around where our biofuels can come from?
Well, the concern was that local livestock feeders, the industry didn't want this bill here in Oregon to create a demand by farmers to divert, if they grow corn, from the local feed into corn ethanol facilities. And so there were incentives put in the bill, again, for a variety of biomass production, but corn was excluded from that. So there's no incentives for farmers to deliver corn to ethanol facilities from this legislation. If the market signals and they want to do that, that's up to them. But that was excluded specifically from the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm learning a lot from this presentation, and I appreciate you coming. Obviously, it's a very complex and sophisticated situation. I would remark, however, I admire your ability to present, because you dodged a huge bullet with Representative Schaffler a little while back on the federal forest. So my hat's off to you. But on this one, at the minimum, I think we can agree that we've got some education to do, not just of legislators, but of the public, because I want to assure you that I'm hearing the opposite of what your economic sort of explanation is from constituents and from farmers. And we're losing support for this, perhaps because of the unfortunate circumstances, you know, of a combination of things that you're describing. But we've got work to do to discuss this or to get that out, because this is losing support since we voted for it in 07, to say the least.
Mm-hmm. The one issue, I mean, I'll just sort of give you my signal in general. You know, I've been largely persuaded by this presentation and other information about my interest, at least, in entertaining an actual repeal of the mandate. So I'm not really interested in that personally. But what I am interested in is conversations, particularly farmers talk to me about the availability of clear gasoline and the need to do something more to deal with, you know, a Washington County farmer who can only buy it in 1,500-gallon minimum batches. And, you know, that's a challenge. So I am interested in talking about availability of clear gasoline. I, you know, particularly not interested. I had a conversation with my friend Representative Gilman about his bill of just repeal the whole thing, and I said, well, let's talk about availability of clear gasoline. So that's sort of where I'm likely to want to take us if we even get the bills. You know, I'm open to people blowing holes in these arguments, challenging facts. I think Brent is as well. It's a topic we are, I think, as Representative Gilman indicated, we're hearing about, and it's not all clear to our constituents, certainly, you know, that these facts are true, so we need information to be able to get to them. I know you're ready to wrap up, but is it fair to, it looks like, if people have issues about their fuel pumps, about mileage, we can refer them to Measurement and Standards Division?
Yes. Feel free to refer them to Department of Agriculture. We've taken a lot of calls. And again, just to put that in context, I know you're hearing from constituents. We have too. We have many millions of or million plus vehicles in Oregon. And we've heard probably a couple hundred calls. Maybe, I don't know if we added them all up. But in the scheme of things, and again, keep in mind, 70% of the fuel nationwide has 10% ethanol. It's a bumpy road we're going through right now, but I think the trajectory is still going to continue. Ethanol's not going to go away. Even if this mandate goes away, there's still a federal mandate. We'll still have ethanol and gasoline. So the issue is, how do we try to benefit here in Oregon, and how do we try to work through the challenges that we're hearing? So,
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair. Well, it does raise a question about mileage, because I'm curious who actually goes out and inspects the pumps on a regular basis, because I'm very good at knowing how far I can get on a tank of gas, and my car has been extremely consistent, and I'm always checking it, and I find that there are some pumps that aren't the same. So I've been curious about how well we've been able to monitor those pumps. And who does that?
Chair Clem and Representative Van Orman. Our Measurement Standards Division is their sole purpose, or one of their sole purposes, is motor fuel quality and measurement. We have staff statewide who, on a fairly routine basis, visit those stations, what you're talking about. They look at those stations to make sure that the quality of the fuel, the octane ratings and those things, water and, you know, those things are where they should be, as well as they look at the pumps to make sure that they, when you buy a gallon of gas, that you're getting that gallon of gas. If you... We get complaints every once in a while from folks like yourselves who feel like something's gone wrong. Our staff, if we know that, you can call our agency. We will send out staff to do some work at those stations to see if there is something going wrong or not. For the most part, I think the Oregon retailers do a great job in this state of managing their motor fuel quality and making sure that their pumps, many times it's could be a defective pump, something mechanically or electronically has gone wrong. Our pumps today are mixing fuel dispensers. They actually mix the fuel right there, and so there are sometimes things that can go wrong, but that's our agency and that's our division, and feel free to call us if you have further questions, or you and I can talk offline if you'd like.
So I need to wrap it up. Thank you very much. The lesson learned part that's in writing is really good because it does put in context. I mean, everything we don't do here, there has to be some other alternative or we're back to foreign oil. You know, that this second generation cellulosic ethanol is really the ideal strategy in the way that I think even the original proponents of this idea admittedly right up front said this is not designed to be what we do forever. It's to try and get us an infrastructure and a market demand. And there's been infrastructure invested in real, you know, 500 million jobs, plants. So that's where you know, I wanted us to sort of at least hear this line of reason. And I appreciate it. Just for folks, we didn't have anybody sign up. I don't know if anybody did want to talk. I ran out of time. But that's my trigger to know if I need to carve out 15 minutes on future topics. Just sign up, and then we would have halted you and let the public comment. And this topic isn't over, I'm certain. At least we'll spend some time on availability of clear gasoline for other uses. With that, I'm going to close our informational meeting and adjourn our committee.
Organizationally, do we leave this?
I don't know.